I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome everybody to this Motorsport Magazine podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned, out of tune, a bit scratched, something past its best. Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz, and certainly not one of the latest models. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. The way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
And what a treat we have for you today. Martin Brundle is our guest, Le Mans winner, F1 driver, and one of the best commentators in the world, and that goes for any sport. Does that make you feel good? Yeah?
That embarrasses me. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. We'll start with the embarrassment. Thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it very much. Also with us is Simon Aaron, who is Motorsport's features editor. Simon has been an F1 reporter for a very long time. I won't say how long. You followed the circuit for a very long time.
Yeah, sort of slightly retired from Formula One now. But yes, I was doing the same thing as Martin, spending my life in departure lounges and hotel lobbies for many, many years.
Okay, so today we are going to discuss Martin's career, or perhaps we should say careers. We're going to talk about Formula One and sports cars and the great drivers he's competed against. And Martin, I'm sorry to do this so early, but let's get the Halo thing discussed and talked about, and then can we just put it away and not talk about it again? Is that all right?
I wish we could put the Halo away and never talk about it again.
So go on then, give us your views.
We will get used to it. I think even in week two of the testing, it's a bit like every time I've seen a 2018 car, it's like talking to somebody that they've got a big red spot on the end of their nose. You try not to look at it, but you can't help it, and it's the first thing I see. It's aesthetically, of course, it's awful, but that's not what upsets me so much about it. It's more that what it stands for, and where for me it's like like the massive runoff areas we have now, and it's just becoming too white, too anesthetized, too it doesn't. It's not how a Formula One car should be. I want to be a little bit frightened when I'm driving a Formula One car, and I want to be a little bit frightened when I'm watching Formula One. That's why we don't want to see death in the name of any sport, of course, and we don't want to see injury. But with the Halo, and once it was declared such a thing existed, of course, the genie was out of the bottle. It has to go on the car because of the blame culture and claim culture that we live in today. But it just... where do we go next? That's my concern. Yeah. A driver will get injured some other way. And for me, if you just carry on like this, you know, ironing the racetracks so they look like billiard tables and creating endless runoffs and hiding the drivers inside the car and behind a halo like this, you just got to carry on and eventually take the driver out of the car. Autonomous racing. Yeah. So I think it's a critical point for Formula One is... What are we? What do we do? For example, if the Six Nations became touch rugby, you'd laugh, wouldn't you? Yes. You'd laugh your head off. Yeah. If we put stabilisers on Valentino Rossi's motorbike, you would laugh. Sadly, I'm not laughing at the Halo. But back in the 70s and 60s, of course, if a driver had a crash, there was a very good chance he was going to break his legs, get burned, or die. And something needs to be done. So they were fundamentals like seat belts, like crash helmets, and you know, putting bag tanks in so the car didn't automatically catch fire. Before that, of course, their best chance of surviving was to get thrown out of the car. That's what they hoped to do. And we've seen the incredible pictures, haven't we, from that era. But this is, you know, we just keep relentlessly now taking the peril out of it. And I don't want the safest place to be at a Grand Prix is inside the racing car. And I only say that slightly jokingly. You know, for me, safety begins first and foremost with the fans. They're paying to be entertained, not injured. Yeah. Next up are the corner workers and marshals and those that are around the track trying to, you know, protect the drivers, as it were. They've not bought into to being injured. They're there to, and often unpaid to, because they have a passion for motorsport and they want to be involved. Next up for me are the people, the pit stop crew. Again, I think they've bought into a certain amount of damage. If you're going to stand there and have some crazy young kid drive at you at 50, 60 miles an hour in a Formula One car while you're going to do a 2-second pit stop. And those people sitting on the pit wall. Yeah. And for me then, the drivers are the last. You know, when you step over the side of a racing car or step into a racing car, you're taking a risk. You bought into a risk. And I think that, I think I've said enough on the Halo. Sorry, that's like 5 minutes, wasn't it? But as you can tell, I'm quite animated about it.
Do you think there will come a time? I mean, you and I grew up, we're only a couple of years different, similar time, watching motor racing through the 60s, the 70s, when there was still a gladiatorial aspect to it almost. Long after our generations have buried and gone and there are no physical memories left of those eras, do you think that there will come a time when people just accept that motor racing is a, because they won't know any different, they won't know that there were ever, you know, there was no runoff area, that there were no bag tanks, that there was no halo. I mean, do you think the sport will survive and people just accept that it's a safe sport, or do you think there's a risk that this continual kind of diminishing of the risk could actually sort of lead to its demise?
I think it's a major issue. Yes, I do. You know, if you look at something like Ultimate Cage Fighting, that's got an incredible following around the world, or boxing or whatever. Mm. You know, if you took the, you know, if you weren't in boxing, if the heavyweight championship of the world was contested by boxers with head protection, their equivalent of halos, like you sometimes see, I think, at the Olympics, don't you? But
the amateurs still have head protection. Yeah.
Yes. Mm. So that's it, isn't it? What are you going to do? You're going to stop boxing? You're going to stop a MotoGP? And of course, we have car manufacturers involved, and they sell their product on safety. Based on safety, a lot of it, isn't it? It's one of their primary selling points. So I see their point. But I've been to some racing drivers' funerals, and I've seen death. I've seen death on a racetrack. My son's a professional racing driver, so I don't take it lightly. They're not throwaway comments on my part, but I do think this is a pivotal point for motorsport and Formula One. And where does it go from here? And then, you know, other people would quite rightly say, well, hang on a minute, you know, what about the crash protection on the side of the car? What about all of the other, you know, the rear crash structure or the other things that we do? Why don't you take those off the car? And, you know, that's a valid point and quite hard to argue against. But this thing just, for me, I'm sorry, is just a step too far.
Yeah, there is a cascade issue, isn't there, that it will lead to other things. But it's going to take a brave person to say this car is safe enough, you know.
Yes, it is. And, of course, you know, if a driver's killed, I'm not the one having to go to court and defend myself because it's not my decision. But I would be happy to be in that position, if I'm honest, because I think... I think we've got, but yes, you know, where do you draw the line in the sand? What is safe enough? What's too safe? What does motor racing stand for? What is the, you know, the USP of Formula One? And for me, that halo and the way the tracks are evolving is too far.
Yep. Okay. Right. I think we've ticked off the halo. Yes.
Must be nearly over.
I think we did well.
Thank you for coming, Martin.
Yeah. I'll tell you, we are now going to do what we always do in the Motorsport podcast. We are going to jump 30 years or so to your early days as a motor racing driver, as a racing driver. But I'm going to ask him, because Simon's always got a really interesting way of communicating, describing how somebody works their way to the top. And yours was an unconventional rise to the top. So I'm going to ask you to describe it, and I'm going to see if Martin
sure I ever made it to the top.
I never got to see Martin racing bangers. Was it Potts Row or Potts Row?
Potts Row. 3 miles from where I live now,
yeah.
Banger racing.
Upmarket banger racing. Now sadly defunct. But I did see what I believe was his first circuit race, and it's when you're a kid, you go along, you look at the race programme, see what's entered, and there was a special saloon race, which meant generally escorts, imps and minis. And there was a bloke entered in a Toyota Celica, and I'd never heard of Martin Brundle. And I was a bit disappointed when I saw the car, to be honest, because it didn't look that modified. It didn't have massive flared arches and a
spoiler when he saw me.
And a spoiler on the back. But it was clearly a relatively I quickly worked out it was a British saloon car championship spec car. And you were 17, I think. You were collecting signatures before you started in the BSCC. But he came to Alton Park and did a special saloon race, March 1977. And he was running up against all these highly modified cars. He was running 8th or 9th or something, I mean, overall against. And he thought, well, that thing shouldn't be anywhere near there. But and I looked at the note, and it said he was 17 or whatever. I read in Autosport or Motoring News. And I thought, that's quite impressive. And I was also jealous because he was only about a year older than I was. The chances of me being in a racing car 12 months from now somewhere south is zero. But yeah. I mean, Martin went from that, and then he appeared in the British Saloon Car Championship back at Alton a few weeks later, and was running right at the front in his class with Richard Lloyd, very experienced driver in his VW Golf. And then he did saloon cars with Audi, then he went Ford 2000, went quite well, then he did Formula 3, and then he met Ayrton Senna and beat him a few times, and 10 minutes later Ken Tyrrell had signed him. So it was came from a field in Norfolk in a banger to a Tyrrell F1 car. Took what, 7 or 8 years?
Well, actually, I'm going to jump in with some research here that I'm not going to waste. your first British Grand Prix to watch, Brands Hatch 66. 10 years later, you were looking to buy a touring car team. 9 years later, you were on the grid for your first ever British Grand Prix. As you watching that Grand Prix in 66, never would have happened, right? You didn't have this burning ambition to be a racing driver, should I say?
No, I might even have been 64. The first one I went to was at Brands Hatch. But I remember my mum waking me up in the like 4 o'clock in the morning, like, Uncle Keith's taking you to the Grand Prix today. I'm like, great. And so I remember mooching around the paddock, picking up all the Yardley BRM stickers and whatever there was at the time. I can't remember the years exactly. And we stood on Paddock Hill Bend. I stood in a polite queue to get Jack Brabham's autograph. He sat in his Ford Zodiac or Zephyr in the paddock afterwards, and he just walked through the paddock. Acker Bilk was playing, I think. We were on the pit strip. We were on the racetrack at one point, and I was just mesmerised by it. Then they only used to go to Silverstone to watch, standing, and we used to take some wood and some cardboard and that to everybody sort of raise themselves up a little bit on the bank at Copps. And did I ever imagine I would be a Formula One driver? No way. It was just inconceivable. It was reasonably fast track. I got lucky along the way that I went hot rod racing. My banger days ended. I won the overall final of the day in my 105E Ford Anglia, and somebody took umbrage at this. So there was an under 1500 class and an over 1500 class. So I'm going around, you put the checkered flag in the window, and I'm going round and celebrating winning the grand final of the day, and I probably got 20 quid for that or something. And this guy reversed round in a, I think it was a Zephyr or something, and wrote me off. He reversed into me and wrote me off. And then came after me with a crowbar in the pits. And my dad came to pick me up because he used to drop me off in the morning. I'd go racing, and when he'd finished selling cars, whatever time of the Sunday that was, pick me up at the end of the day in our transit. And we decided that was we've got to get out of this. We went Speedworth Hot Rod Racing, except the problem is I was 15. I needed to be 16. So we told fibs about that. Then I was racing the great Barry Lee and people like that, George Pollard. Polly. Duffy Collard and people like that at the Hot Rods, which was fantastic. Then I saw in Autosport one morning, we were Toyota dealers, and I saw in Autosport one morning the Toyota team for sale. And it was the truck, the Transporter, and both Wyn Percy's and Wizzo Williams' car was for sale. So we went to Brands Hatch. I met Wyn Percy, who is one very much was and remains one of my heroes. And we ended up buying these cars. So we financed the two Celicas as demonstrators, and we HP'd the truck as a breakdown truck for the garages. We had nil money. So when I went to Alton Park for that first race in the Celica, it was Wyn's car. And I remember going to find a phone box in Alton Park, no mobile phones back in 1977, of course. And I stood behind a guy who used to race a Scirocco. Brian somebody had a Scirocco.
Brian Pepper?
Yeah, it sounds about right. And I'm waiting in line to phone to go, I'm on pole. You'd never guess what I'm on pole. And this guy, right in front of me, was on the phone. He goes, you'll never guess what? It's a 17-year-old on pole. And I was quite proud of myself. And in that race, I got a puncture. And I'll never forget Bernard Unet in an Avenger following me, chasing me. And he just had this grisly grin. I could see it in my mirror. And he frightened me off the track in the end. I got a puncture going down Cascades, and I could go on forever, really, all the stories. But yeah, so bit of single seater, that fell apart. Back to touring cars. I was teammates with Stirling Moss. People never believe me when I say I was teammates Stirling Moss in 1981. And then BP took me into single seater racing, and then Ayrton turned up, and boom, we're both in Formula One. Yeah.
I think it's an interesting point that when we look at Formula One today and we look at the schooling of the drivers and the fact Max was in F1 at 17, 18, 19. It's not unusual for these guys to be in Formula One when they're teenagers now. But they've been kart racing since they were kids. Do either of you think that a driver will reach Formula One with an unconventional background like yours? Do you think it's possible anymore for someone to go left, right, and then find themselves at the top?
I'm not sure it's wrong to say that it's not possible to do it without money anymore, because there are guys in there at the moment like Van Dorn, Bottas, who haven't come from Raikkonen, who've not come from massive family money. Ocon's another one, who've basically been picked up when they were young because their dad sacrificed stuff and they got spotted and then got help. But you need that help at an early stage now, don't you? Because if you don't, you're not going to get a sort of sugar daddy. It was very unlikely to find a sugar daddy who's going to sponsor you all the way through, F3, F2, whatever. Yeah. You need to be picked up by Red Bull, Mercedes, or...
Yeah, but it's not just the dad that sacrifices, the whole family do, actually.
No, absolutely.
My mum sacrificed loads and holidays and all sorts of things for my racing, and the siblings have to put up with sitting in a car in a paddock or... And it's quite a tough one, actually, because if you've got one sibling that goes racing and another that doesn't, how do you balance that up? How do you keep that fair? To answer your question, I don't think it's possible anymore to come through without doing karting and the junior formulae. And of course, now there are point systems in place, aren't there? You've got to go through some of those. Yeah. You can't just leap into a Formula One car anymore to get your super license. So I think, if you're not karting by 7, 8 years old, it'd be very hard to play catch up.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think... Did the Ibanga racing at Pot Row, did that not count for points for your super licence?
Well, clearly it did, because I got one in the end. But I tell you what it did do is when I had drivers trying to push me off the track, let's not name names. Let's not. It was nothing for me, Every time Shumi or anybody, even when I was his teammate, would try and push me off the road, it was like... That's nothing, mate, compared to having a Ford Zephyr 6 coming at you
backwards
yeah. in your Ford Anglia. You can't frighten me.
But I mean, although karting is, is long. I mean, the karting culture didn't exist when you were coming through the ranks. It's not on the same scale. What you did in hot rod racing, I mean, in terms of car control, traffic management, everything else, that must have been just as good. 40 odd cars in a tightly tightly squashed.
No
over
contact.
Like that.
No, no contact at all. Yeah. It was. I liked hot rod racing's good. Yeah, really good. And you had to work your way through the pack and just edge, you know, edge through the traffic and without bumping into anything.
And you know, but anyway. I mean, plotting a move, it could take two or three laps to get a move nailed because of the
Went around the outside. Definitely.
Maybe we need a hot rod revival. Like there's a Goodwood revival. Somewhere.
It still exists.
Well, Wimbledon, Wimbledon closed down, didn't it?
It did, but yeah, still, there are still outposts, just not in London.
I'm going to jump now to a subject that I know that's close to your heart, the Grand Prix Trust. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the Grand Prix Trust and your role with them. And maybe how our readers and listeners can get involved.
Yeah, and I think there might well be a lot of motorsport listeners and readers, magazine readers, who will be interested in this and who can help us, actually, because they may well know some people who need some help. So I took over from Jackie Stewart. So Jackie Stewart as the chairman of the trustees a year or so back. Jackie started this in the 1980s. It was called the Grand Prix Mechanics Trust back then. We dropped the name mechanic because in Formula One parlance these days, you know, mechanic doesn't. It's there is no category of mechanic today, but of course there used to be. So, and we like to help people out where we can who fall on hard times, particularly with their health or other issues, financial issues. And over 150 teams have gone broke in Formula One because a lot of people say, "Well, Formula One's so rich, you know, why do you need to help people out in Formula One?" Well, of course the current teams are. There's 10 of them, and they've got HR departments. But I'm surprised today, even how many people we help, where they get into some problems that are beyond the remit and resource of a Formula One team, you know, human resource department. Yeah. But fundamentally, we're there for the stalwarts and the pioneers of yesteryear. It's a 67-year history of Formula One. As I said, 150 teams plus have gone out of business. There were no pensions, healthcare plans, and all of that back in those days. And Jackie was absolutely right to start this up, and we've helped a lot of people over the course of time. So it's applicable now to anybody who's been involved in Formula One for 2 years or more, in any role, actually, anywhere in the world. And we've helped people in Australia and all that sort of thing, who maybe, or and New Zealand, who were Formula One mechanics, you know, back in the day, in the 60s and 70s or whatever, who end up with some difficulties. So I would say if you, Grand Prix Trust, it's online. I also am trying to make it more of a social media hub as well for people who want to stay in touch with Facebook or whatever, and sort of re-meet some of their old colleagues or communicate with them. So we quietly do a lot of good. Obviously, I can't explain some of the things where we've helped individuals because of confidentiality, and I wouldn't want to do that. So we've got two ladies who work for us, Ali in the administration, Sally, who is our client coordinator. She's highly trained in, and do you know, sometimes we help a lot of people out without spending £1 because Sally knows where all the green buttons are. There's so many facilities out there in social care that you don't know what you don't know. So if somebody knows, like, okay, you've got that problem, well, here's you know, contact these people, here's this facility. And we do a lot of good. And so anybody that can help us, I would appreciate. And if anybody reading Motorsport Mag and listening to this knows of people who have been involved in Formula One who have ended up with problems, then contact the Grand Prix Trust.
Okay, thanks, Martin.
I mean, what sort of fundraising activities do you do?
We get donations. We've got an industry leader challenge this year. I've got Christian Horner's going to try and drive with Terry Grant on two wheels. We're just finding an Aston Martin for him to do that in now. we are so Christian. I think he's regretting saying he would do that. We had a very generous donation recently. But Jackie always talked about the big one. You know, a car over the pit wall into the pit lane, you know, and hurting a lot of people. I think safety regulations and multi-level of insurances has sort of negated that concern as the decades have passed since he started this in the 80s. For me now, the big one, I look at Formula One and I see between 700 and 1,000 people making two racing cars for 21 races effectively. And I look at that and think, that's unsustainable. Mm. I don't think that's going to last.
Yeah.
Sad to say, I'd like to see a lot more teams come in so we can fill the grid up with 26 cars and absorb. But for me, there's going to be a change. It has to. It's when Ross left Mercedes, there was a cap of 650 people. Now there are 1,000 people. Is it going to go to 1,500 people? What's going to happen? So there's going to be a change, and I think the Grand Prix Trust will be there when it's needed.
Okay. If you would like some more information on the Grand Prix Trust, then please head to our website. I mean, obviously, you can Google the Grand Prix Trust. We'll be posting an article on motorsportmagazine.com about the Trust and the great work that it does. And to reiterate, anyone who's been involved in Formula One for two years from a truckie, marketing, good old-fashioned mechanic.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, great stuff. Right, okay, so I think around 10 years after the early saloon car adventures, you're in Rio, must have felt tremendously exotic, exciting, and you're about to test your first Formula One car. And I'm sure I read in your book that 12 laps after you started your test, your head was falling off your shoulders.
I came in the pits and stopped. Well, really embarrassingly, I came in the pits, and of course I'd only ever done F3 and that sort of thing. I came in the pits for the first time at the end of my 12 lap run to this sea of colour. I didn't know, I couldn't remember where my pits were. I was in a terrible, like, I stopped at every pit along the way and they're all laughing at me and waving me through. I mean, I didn't have all the fancy rig like they have today. And you could imagine the hardened, wizened Formula One mechanics were like, get off. And eventually I stopped and recognised some people from the Tyrrell team. And I sat there, and then the heat of Rio the F1 car, and I'd driven the Tyrrell at Silverstone on a crispy morning and gone very well, and I'd driven the McLaren with an amazing day with Senna and Beloff and myself. We're all given a test drive in the McLaren again on a cold, crispy day at Silverstone. Suddenly I'm in the heat and humidity of Rio, and all the heat coming off the radiator. Yeah. It was that little Tyrrell 012, the one that stopped.
The side pods were back here, weren't they?
The one that stopped around my elbow, didn't it? And you're sort of sitting on top of it. And the rads were just sitting there, and it welled up, and I had to get out because I was going to throw up, basically, which was a great start.
Was there any preparation? Yeah, I mean, did anyone ever say to you, this is going to be tough, you're going to struggle, you need to do this, you need to hang some weights off your neck? Was there any preparation in that respect?
No, I didn't know anything about that. I should have done, but I didn't know anything about it at all, nor did Senna.
I was going to say, Eng's neck didn't hold out either. Did his neck last 12 laps, or did you beat him on that one?
I don't know. Well, my career started a lot better than Eddie's, and he was really annoyed about it. He was really annoyed about it, because I was fifth in the first Grand Prix. But I hadn't got the drive at this point.
Right.
So Ken took me to the test. And if you remember, back in those days, the only sponsor on the side of the car was Tyrrell.
And now we think, wasn't that pretty?
Yeah, it was a beautiful looking car, but in that respect. And I remember I had one set of qualies. I'm going down the back straight, and Derek Warwick's catching me in the works Renault down the back. And remember, the normally aspirated versus turbo, it was like a 30 mile an hour speed difference down the back straight. And Derek edges up alongside me. I don't know whether he was on qualies or not. And I'm like, I can't lift. This is my one quali lap. So I just almost close my eyes and turn in. Because Rio was just a huge number of high-speed left-hand turns. Do you remember Piquet winning there? With his head
fell out of the car, didn't he?
Flailing out the side of the car. It was so tough. Yeah. And I can't lift. And I cut Derek off. And of course, from the pits, you could see the back straight and the turn. I remember on race day, because there was no cover to the grandstand, the fire, because they used to come in really early, the fans, and sit there with no cover in the sun. And they used to take a fire hose down there and hose the crowd off, basically, to cool them down, because they'd be sitting there for hours waiting for us to race. And Ken Tyrrell saw this and he loved it. Ken loved that kind of thing, that I cut up the works Renault driver to get my lap in. But I still hadn't got the drive. And then I got called down to Ockham in February or something like that. and went into Ken's office. That was a nice 6-hour return drive, that was, for me from Norfolk. Mm. No problems. Here we go. And he said to me, unfortunately, and I'd offered him £150,000 sponsorship, which I didn't have £1 of. I didn't have a quid, but I thought I'll worry about that later. And he said, okay, the bad news is I haven't found a sponsor. And my heart sank. He said, but the good news is I'm going to sign you anyway. And I'm like, I want to climb all over the ceiling. And I just sat there. I remember it so clearly, sitting in Ken's office, and you could see Bo, who used to do the fiberglass stuff and make you seats, you know, looking out, going, he was doing that behind Ken's shoulder. And he said, and I know you haven't got £150,000, so let's forget that. And off we went racing. He gave me a car. I earned £30,000 the first year, including all of my own. I had to pay all my own expenses. So I made more money on the cheap Mercedes deal we were allowed to do back then than I did driving the car. I made $2,000 or $3,000 out of that or something. And I got the drive, incredibly.
Do you think that chopping the Renault had... Do you think Ken...
It didn't do any harm.
Yeah.
Ken loved all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
A bit of a racer.
Yeah. A related note to the physicality of driving a Formula One car then and now. Is there a kind of a weird pleasure in the physicality of racing a car? Are you all masochists, is I guess what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, you want to. I mean, obviously it's changed significantly, and I'm not saying it's not as good now, because but it's different. I mean, I've driven three of these hybrid Formula One cars, and they are, my God, they're brilliant. You spend your whole life debriefing in an engineering meeting as a racing driver, looking for tiniest, you know, and then you jump in something like the latest Mercedes. Had more grip in the pouring rain than I remember anything I drove just
amazing.
And the power, the relentless linear power, the gearbox. You know, you get a beep in your ear to change gear. You don't two laps in, and it's, you don't even think about it. You know, you get out, and they, when you're debriefing, they ask you about the gearbox. You're like, I don't know, I didn't notice the gearbox. I'm sure I must have used it. It is so unbelievably good. The brakes are... So they're masterpieces now, and so the drivers now start homing in to be super accurate, you know, braking within a metre or two, and the line, the speed they carry, and all of that sort of thing. So the skill demands have changed, whereas back in those early days, the cars were monsters, basically. Yeah. And I don't say it jokingly, your primary role was to stop them from crashing through the afternoon, then to go a little bit faster if you could, and then try to keep the car together. So you had to nurse the car, the dog rings, the drive shafts, the clutch, the brakes, the everything about it. And there were, you know, shifting 2,700 times in Monaco, you get out and you've got blood pouring out of the palm of your hand. You've literally worn all the skin off the palm of your hand. And there was a certain amount of... I took on that car and that racetrack, and I beat it. I somehow got to the end of it. There was that sort of that endurance element of it, but you know, they were just flying bedsteads. They were death traps, basically.
Was there any, is there any correlation whatsoever, apart from the fact they've got a wheel at each corner and a number on the side, between something like the first Tyrrell Renault Turbo you drove and the modern generation of Grand Prix car?
In terms of how they handle and perform, no, of course, no. You know, the Tyrrell, when I was qualifying in Monaco or Adelaide with 1,200 horsepower, it would spin its wheels in top gear halfway down the back straight in Adelaide. It's like a little bump, and next thing you've lit the rear tires up, and you're on a qualifying lap, and you're in top gear. But you know what, Simon? I know you love going to Alton and Cadwell, and it doesn't matter what you drive, the challenge is the same. You've got a certain amount of power and a certain amount of grip. Go as fast as you can within the limitations of what you got, and look after it. And it doesn't matter whether it's Lewis Hamilton's latest and greatest 2018 Formula One car, or like the beautiful Aston Martin or Ferrari that I drove at Goodwood Revival.
Okay, well, we are going to slow the pace. This is the retail opportunity that I drop in at this point. And we're going to slow the pace, but maybe we're not going to slow the excitement. there is a G-Class Ultimate 4x4 driving experience available at the moment via our partners at Mercedes-Benz. You can enjoy the new G-Class Ultimate 4x4 driving experience, and the expiry date is a year from the purchase, so please take a look at the website or phone 0370 400 4000 and quote G-Class Ultimate 4x4. Are you a 4x4? Do you like going out in the green lanes and enjoying
it? Yeah, I have a 4x4 in the family. Is that the new G-Class?
That is the new G-Class.
That's a great looking. I'd like to have a go in that.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. So take a look. That's from our partners at Mercedes-Benz. Right. Bouncing back to turbocharged Formula One cars. And actually, you mentioned earlier on your teammate, Stefan Beloff. We've had a few questions about Stefan. I think his story is well known. I was trying to think last night what question to ask you about Stefan that maybe hasn't been asked before. And all I could think of was if you were his manager with the knowledge that you have today, how would you plot his career for him? Now, I know this is not necessarily an easy question to answer. Yeah, Stefan Beloff, yeah. But to many people, it was like he didn't necessarily have guidance. If you could go back, manage him, where would you have steered him? How would you have got him to the top?
I'm not sure I'm qualified to say on something like that. But he was driving a Porsche because A, he was brilliant in them. Mm. And B, and I stood and watched him die, unfortunately, because I was driving a Jaguar in the same race. And I'm just about to get in the pit lane as he came down the hill into Eau Rouge. And I was driving the Jaguar because A, I was pretty handy in it. And B, just like Beloff, I needed the money.
Right.
Because he would, I don't know if he was on the same deal as me, but I doubt he'd been getting paid more than me. That was I think we got 60 grand in the second year, 30 grand in the first year. And Tyrrell was always a bit, shaky in terms of its finances. You had to go and drive those other cars. And so you had a foot in both camps, which served me very well later on when I flicked back into sports cars and reinvigorated my reputation, my career, if you like. Tim Clues, the very well-known man who used to insure everybody, once said to me, a great, great guy and very supportive of us all, and he sponsored me in Formula 3, Tim did, when the Eddie Jordan truck went over the cliff and my number one mechanic, Rob Bowden, was killed and our cars ended after I'd won the Formula 3 race in Austria. Tim funded us getting back on track to go and take the fight to Senna again at the next round, and also, so I want to paint him as a racer and not in any negative way. But he said to me, Beloff was never going to make old bones, and I think he was right. Yeah. He had a bravery and a fearlessness that was just outstanding, extraordinary. And I think also he was desperately trying to make a point that day. Going round the outside of the works Porsche in front of the hole, because the pit lane was on that side back then. So if you could give him some advice, and I remember going to his funeral and it broke me to bits, because to see this distress of his girlfriend and his family and all that sort of thing, I was like, because you're so selfish when you're a racing driver, you never stop to think about any of that. But he probably needed a bit of control to go with his to go with his speed and fearlessness. But I remember we were in when we were racing Zandvoort one day, and we had a piece of string, one in front of the other, whatever. We were always nose to tail in our Tyrrells up against the turbos. On race day, we had we were much closer, especially when we had the super lightweight one. But Stefan would make a move into Tarzan. I'm like, how did he get away with that? And then he'd make another move. I'm like, come on, Martin. Yes. And I'd make a big move. The next thing is Beloff would be two cars behind me, because he would then make another move, and it was a one move even wilder. Didn't pay off. If I think of him, so if you were to put control with his speed and bravery, then I have no doubt he would have been certainly a multiple race winner in Formula One, and possibly a champion.
Okay.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
We're going to jump into some reader questions. Now, our readers, I mention this in most of our podcasts, but they're quite brave. So, usually braver than we are.
Throw me in,
Adam. You're sitting here, aren't
you? Exactly, yeah. But they're very knowledgeable audience, and thanks, everyone, for sending your questions in. First one is from Oscar Matsurath about your debut F1 season. You lost some incredible results because of Tyrrell's misdemeanours. You came close to winning at Detroit. Do you think the punishment fitted the crime?
No, it didn't, because we were thrown out for having an auxiliary fuel tank. They found a trace. Ken wouldn't sign, because we didn't have a turbo, Ken wouldn't sign a document, and it needed unanimity from all the team bosses. And so they found a trace of fuel in a water tank and threw us out for an auxiliary fuel tank. Well, we never used to fill it, because we had the DFV and then DFY. We never used to fill the main fuel tank up. We didn't have enough power to fill the tank up, let alone an auxiliary one. So and of course, with Ken thrown out of the championship, and I found out about that when I was in a room in Harley Street with my legs strapped up and all plastered up, and a guy called Barry Gill, a great journalist called Barry Gill, rang me, somehow got through to my room in a Harley Street clinic, and said, "Hello, mate, what have you got to say about Tyrrell being disqualified from the championship?" Like, what? He's kidding me. Ken hadn't got around to telling me at that point. Probably didn't want to, as I was already smashed to bits from my accident in Dallas. The punishment didn't fit the crime. We were running. Ken worked out that you could weigh a car before a race and you could weigh a car after a race. You couldn't weigh it during the race. So, but we were fighting cars with 200-300 horsepower more than us. Yeah, it was cheeky. That was 84, wasn't it? Yeah, not in 85. We still had a great little car in 85, but you know, that was very cheeky. But it was, and of course, with Ken out of the championship, he no longer had a vote, and whatever they wanted to do with turbo engines got voted through. So that was what that was all about. It was a political thing. It wasn't a technical thing.
Right, okay. I'm going to jump over.
Thanks for reminding me.
Sorry about that.
and I've still got the trophy at home.
Oh, yeah, that's not going anywhere. Okay, this is going to take you to the other side of the pond. Ed Carlton asks, can you talk about your time in the States doing the IROC series? How did it come about? What was the reception like from the other drivers, especially Dale Earnhardt Sr.?
It was Tony Dow, who was running the IMSA JAG team, recommended I do it, and I turned up. I won the first race in Cleveland. I'd worked out there was this big water tank sitting in this thing, and I said to my mechanic, what exactly is that? You know, it wasn't exactly Formula One, it was in the footwell, it was this great big water tank. He said, that's the brake cooling, and I could just feel a little micro switch under the brake pedal, and you could see the water go down and all that sort of thing. Oh, that's interesting. So in the race, I started eighth, I was third at the first corner, and I just took off and left them. It was a fantastic field of drivers, Emo and all the NASCAR guys.
Probably a couple of answers in there.
Danny
as well,
Sullivan, yeah. Al Jr., yeah. And all sorts of things. And so down all the straights, I just felt this little click underneath my foot, and I cooled my brakes. And as they began to run out of brakes, I got them to top the thing right up, and I just took off and won the race by miles. The guy who got upset about that, funny enough, was Terry Labonte. So we're in the cool down area, Parc Fermé would be too posh a word for it, Cleveland Airfield. And Emo came up to me, I mean, Martin, you drove a beautiful race today. Because that's how... Emma was just the loveliest man.
Charming man, yeah.
Terry Labonte gets out of his car and goes, who won? Did he win? And somebody said that I had won the race. And then I can't use the words because they're bad words. But then he started banging on the roof of his IROC car. I don't believe... with a few more expletives in there. And I thought, well, that's not very friendly, is it? But now I'm leading the championship. And we did Michigan... and eventually Talladega, but they had me in the fence. There was no way. I was leading the championship, and there was no way. It was $125,000. There was no way this little spotty kid from Europe was going home with $125,000. I think I finished second or third in the championship. But the Dale Earnhardt reference is obviously a story I told at Autosport Awards one night when. So our second child, Alex, was due. And it became a big story because the race got rained off. And now, you know, was I going to go home to the birth of my son? I was just being a selfish racing driver, so I didn't. And luckily, Liz waited with Alex until I... So the race was delayed a day. And there was quite a lot of media around that. So I'm sitting on the grid. I'm on pole. I'm leading the championship. It's Talladega, I believe it was, the final round. And Dale Earnhardt walks by because you have those net. You don't have windows. You have those nets in the sides. They're basically NASCARs. They were NASCARs, yeah. But they're all the same. And Earnhardt walks past with his dark glasses on, with like a 1,000-yard stare behind them. And as he goes past my netted window, he said, "Don't forget your kids," and carried on walking. And somehow, going into turn one, he came underneath me and passed me. Anyway, it was. Who was it who drew the short straw to have me off? Rusty Wallace, I think.
You think they colluded?
Oh, of course. I don't know. That's a long time ago now, but I just knew I wasn't going to win that race.
Going home. Yeah.
Good racing, though. I loved it.
Yeah, I read in your book that you got turned around or you had a spin on an oval.
Coming off turn four. I remember them saying to me, whatever you do, Daryl Waltrip said to me, who I got on, I just love Daryl Waltrip. He's such a character. He said, whatever you do, don't hit the end of the pit wall. And as I got spun around, I felt each of the four tyres go bang as you wore a hole in the bottom of them, going 190 miles an hour sideways. And now I'm going down the grass and I'm heading for the end of the pit wall, thinking exactly what Daryl told me. Luckily, it stopped before I got there.
So which was more terrifying, that or a Zephyr 6 reversing towards you in
man
a field.
With a crowbar.
Well, there's the man with a crowbar. And I was the Zephyr 6 probably, yeah, because I was, you know, what was I, 15 at the time, and I couldn't see over a steering wheel, so I was looking through the steering wheel. So the Zephyr 6 looked rather big at that point.
But I'm sure I read in your book that you managed to turn it around. You figured out how you could get the car back pointing the right way, and then, of course, you had to do that again in Adelaide, was it, in the wet? To get the car, although you weren't entirely sure whether you were pointing the right way.
I had to go in the pit. No, that was one of the scariest things that happened to me. There's a picture, isn't there, of Senna coming out of Senna hitting me from behind when his team were trying to tell him to slow down. He was angry, wasn't he, because of the problems that had happened in Suzuka and all that sort of thing, 89. And I was on Pirellis. It was pouring with rain. We weren't going to race. And Alan Prost, and we'd all agreed we weren't going to race because it was diabolical. Bernie walked down the grid and said, get in the car, the race is about to start, to all of us. So we all got in the car and started. Prost pulled in at the end of the first lap. We go racing. And on the Pirelli wets back then, my little Brabham was just... So I'm in top gear and I'd loop down the back straight. The Brabham straight, is it called? And somehow I didn't hit the wall extraordinarily. I was running seventh and there were loads of cars everywhere. And I'm like, get out of it. Hooked first gear, drove off and realised I didn't know how many times I'd spun. Was it three times? Was it three and a half times? Which direction was I now? It's just two concrete walls and the Brabham straight. I didn't know which direction I was heading in. And all I could do was carry on because I knew there were other cars on the racetrack and the conditions were diabolical. And then I saw the numbers on the brake marker board into the hairpin, and I realised I was going the right way. That was pretty scary. So next time down the down the back straight, I'm in fifth gear going, I can't let that happen again, flat out in top. And that's when Senna smashed into the back of me, and he came past me on three wheels. He hit me so hard, he actually overtook me on three wheels.
Was it when you were talking earlier about queuing up to get Jack Brabham's autograph at Brands in 1723, whenever it was.
Yeah.
Was there any special resonance for you when you ended up actually signing? I know Jack had long gone from Formula One then, but the fact you actually ended up driving a Brabham.
I hadn't really thought of it like that. Obviously, Brabhams were winning a lot of races when I first got into Formula One, so it was...
Which they weren't when you signed for them.
Bernie had left by then, hadn't he? Bernie had gone to run Formula One, so I enjoyed my day. I had 2 years at Brabham. I enjoyed all my days in Formula One, to be honest. The Zach Speed decision wasn't my greatest decision, but at the time I didn't have any options. And they tried their best. So, no, I mean, I you know, if people say, who do you drive for? And I list them, and it's McLaren and Benetton and Brabham and Ligier, and, you know, I'm proud of all of those.
Let's look at the time after Zach Speed, and, of course, to Le Mans. Was there a sense of kind of, encouragement for Brendan Hartley when he came into Formula One? Because he'd gone away and come back. You'd gone away to sports cars, Le Mans, and come back as well. Have you got a kind of a... I'd have a soft spot for him if I was...
Good luck to the lad and all of them, you know, coming in. It's hard to get to Formula One. It's even harder to stay there.
Yeah.
And that's something I've said for 30-odd years now. And it's as true today as it was at any point. I think you get a discipline in sports car racing. You learn to work with others, you learn how to... It's probably, you know, if you come through junior single-seater racing, you're not representing a manufacturer, you're not representing big sponsors, you know, it's whoever's funding you and your car and your team, you're passing through. All of a sudden, you've got to be out there representing a global manufacturer, and I think it teaches you a lot of things on and off track that are very useful in Formula One. It makes you grow up a little bit and see a bigger picture. And think the longer game in the car as well. You're not just in a 20-lap Formula 3 race. You're suddenly going to get a quadruple stint through the pouring rain at night at Le Mans, and it makes you grow up quite fast.
Speaking of global manufacturers, Fernando Alonso is going to be effectively representing three over the next 18 months, McLaren, Renault and Toyota. From our perspective in the office, it's good on him. You know, he's going for two incredibly physical, punishing seasons. I think he's got 10 weekends back to back. It's pretty extraordinary. Do you think he's nuts, or do you think he's a hero?
I admire him, and you know, I wish on as a Grand Prix driver, I always wanted to race a Lotus Cortina and a Formula 2 car on the same day, like my heroes Jim Clark and Graham Hill and Jackie Stewart used to do. But then you end up specialising. If I was McLaren, I wouldn't let him do it. Because it's going, you know, it's going to distract him at some point, travel wise, or just jumping between the cars. But they had to keep him happy. I observed him at Daytona this year. My son was racing. I observed him when he was at Bahrain and Le Mans previously. Yes. He's totally engaged. His work ethic is incredible. And you see the other things he's got in his life, his karting circuit, his museum, and other commercial things. He's going to be one very busy guy. But no, I applaud him for being able to jump in different cars. And, you know, as I used to do, you know, as we used to, if to race, you know, touring cars, sports cars, Formula One cars, classics, all that. It's just brilliant. Why wouldn't you? If you have a passion for driving racing cars, why wouldn't you drive anything as much as you could at any time?
Yeah. I think you may have stumbled across a really interesting support race idea there as well. Maybe the current guys in Lotus Cortinas.
Yeah.
What do you reckon?
On three wheels.
Coming through. Okay, right. So this is where we genuinely jump around. This here, there, and everywhere. So Jamie Smith asks, it's a very simple one. I'd like to hear some stories of driving for Eddie Jordan.
Eddie Jordan. Well, yes, it's funny, isn't it? Because I drove for Eddie. I I was sitting in Dave Price's office. We got to the end of the 82 Form 3 season, and BP had decided that they were going to fund Calvin Fish because he'd beaten Ayrton in a Formula Ford 2000 race. And good driver, Calvin, and a good lad, and stay in touch with him. He's over doing similar job to me, but over in the States now. So I'd won the Commonwealth Driver of the Year, Grovewood Award, was it called back then? £5,000. But I hadn't got a drive, and I sat in Pricey's office, and he's like, "Marty, I ain't got nothing for you, mate. I'm going to ring somebody who has." And the person he rang who had got, he thought might have something for me, was Eddie Jordan. So I went straight from Pricey's up to Silverstone, stayed the night at Eddie's place in Silverstone Village. And it turns out Eddie hadn't got any money either. But somehow we hustled through, and I gave him the £5,000 check. I painted one of his best friend's Toyota Hilux trucks in our paint shop at the Toyota myself. And we took a Citroen 7-seater familial estate off the forecourt we couldn't sell. And that became the crew bus. And so that's how we started racing. Eddie blagged money out of Silverstone. Tom Walkinshaw helped us. He loaned us some money he never got back, but I paid him back in many other ways, driving his cars later on. And Racing for Britain came in at a critical time and gave us some money. And so we set off. We started that season with £5,000 Grovewood Award and painting a truck. And we ended up doing 21 or 22 races or something like that, with the European races that we went into and won. And that put me into Formula One. And then I ended up my career. So Eddie rang me from a pedalo on a lake in Italy. He'd just sold Eddie Irvine to Ferrari, basically, and got a chunk of change. But what he did have was a sponsor in Benson Hedges who demanded a British driver. So he just flogged Eddie. And he needed a Brit in the car. And so we kind of did a deal. I rang Tom. I was driving for Ligier at the time. I said, "Tom, I can't turn this deal down." And he wasn't very pleased, but he agreed. And I ended up racing for Eddie. It was a slightly difficult year because the car didn't work as well as we hoped it would aerodynamically.
It didn't when it was upside down in Australia, did it?
No. That's Coulthard's fault and Herbert's fault. Tripped over each other. No, I started. No, I blew up in... but I blew up quite a lot of times that year, but I blew up in practice and ended up at the back of the grid. And I was started 19th. I was P6 or P7 by turn three, but unfortunately I was upside down at that moment. Yeah.
So do you think Lance Stroll's ever painted a Toyota Hilux truck on his, to raise funds for rail? I'm just curious. I don't know, you might.
You know what, you use whatever facilities are available to you, don't you? I doubt it very much, but I could paint a mean truck, actually.
Okay, remember that. So Martin Brundle,
past tense.
Just we place a very cheap ad if you'd, you know. Right, Bill in Sydney, and this is Jordan related. It's the Colin McRae. You swapped cars with him at Silverstone 96, I think. Yeah. Bill says. What were your impressions of Colin's driving that day? And I'll add to that. Could he have stuck it on the grid for a race?
Yeah, definitely. Colin was fast. He got in the car, fearless. I mean, he did a practice start and came so close to wiping the car down the pit wall at Silverstone because there were no devices there to save you. It was just pure. And so he dialed so much energy into the transmission system. Yeah. Tripping over my tongue here. It just lit it up, and there was so much energy in the rear tyres. He just about wiped it down the wall. But that aside, he drove really well. Mm-hmm. And I think there is no doubt that if Colin... And he drove at Le Mans, didn't he, in a Ferrari? I think there's no doubt with calming down a bit and some time, he would have been a fast racing driver. Why not? Yeah. My overriding impression of that day was... thankfully, I didn't. He couldn't fit me in the single-seater to take me round Silverstone, thank God. But of course... he had to come in the rally car with me. I've never seen a man looking for an imaginary brake pedal so much as we went through the forest with me barely in control of this Subaru Impreza. And I could see him looking ahead, pressing the brake pedal like crazy. We didn't crash.
And most racers and rally drivers are awful passengers, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I certainly am.
Yeah. Okay, Patrick Down. Jump in at any time because I'm going to try and run through these, and I'm sure you've got 101 questions as well. Question from Patrick Down. Schumacher and Häkkinen, both teammates in the early 90s. Who was faster? Are there any other teammates on their sort of level but just didn't get the chance to prove it? So Schumacher and Häkkinen, who was the quickest? Let's say it's a one lap. Absolutely
Häkkinen
speed. Right.
Häkkinen, would, I think, is the fastest teammate I ever had in terms of raw sheer speed. Yeah, you've always got to, there's always somebody around who's going to spoil your party, isn't there? I mean, I came through Formula 3 against Senna and then end up as teammates with Häkkinen and Schumacher. But there's always, you've got to beat them whether they're in the same team or another team. So Michael drove, I always say Ayrton drove with his heart, Michael drove with his head. Mika just had pure brutal speed and relied on everybody else to deliver him the car that would it's such a straightforward, simple approach to his racing, and he just drove the car and left the engineers to worry about the rest of it, from what I could tell. Whereas Michael was much more engaged in, you know, galvanizing and bringing everybody else around him. But I don't think Michael had quite, and we're talking tiny amounts here. Ayrton had the most God-given talent I've ever seen. I think he just had a... I always explain it that Ayrton had a feel for grip before and during a corner, where us mere mortals had a feel for grip during and after a corner. And I don't know if I've got time to bore you with a story about him at Silverstone with Ayrton Senna. And... pouring a rain, we headed off. I got a better start. We're on the front row of the grid. I lead down into Stowe corner, pouring with rain. And Senna goes down the outside. And I'm thinking, see you, wouldn't want to be you out there. Yeah, Senna's off. He went skirting all the way around the outside on the karting line, which I never did karting, so I wasn't really sort of much into that. And came out in front of me, came out of Stowe corner in front of me. How did you do that? And I was miffed with it. And then they threw the red flags. Kiki Mansilla had a massive shunt somewhere, threw the red flags. So we all come back to the pits. Now we're going to, you know, go back round to restart the race. I thought, I'm going to try Senna's line through Stowe. Went down there, hit a puddle of water, went on the grass, just kept it out of the barriers around the outside of the grass. And I went, there used to be a little rubbish out there on the outside of Stowe corner. Survived for another day, restarted the race. Senna beat me off the line this time. He won the race, I was second. And on the podium, I said to him, your line through Stowe didn't work in the second part of the race, did it? He said, I don't know, I didn't try, it was too wet.
Damn him.
And that sums up Ayrton Senna's talent to me. He had this gift to know where the grip was.
Okay, this I'm going to hook your comment there about teammates with something that Rob JW has asked, and it's about another teammate, but Stirling Moss. Different cars, different era. Rob asked, you know, what is it like to have him as a teammate? I'm going to ask, was he a head or a heart driver, Stirling, from what you saw?
He was just silky smooth. Right. He regrets doing that, Stirling, coming back. He always says it's... I don't know how he was 51 years old. I was 21 years old. It was 1981. I was stupid. All I wanted to do is blow the doors off Stirling Moss, which I did because, you know, it was slick tires and, you know, and basically, fundamentally, I was the quicker driver. And instead of going, what can I learn? You know, thankfully, Stirling and Susie are friends of ours to this day, and I hold the man in I could not hold him in any higher esteem, of course, and I'm sure we're all the same, but I didn't learn as much from Stirling as I could. I remember one day at Brands Hatch when it was half wet, half dry, he just waltzed off into the distance because that was the kind of grip level he was used to, basically. Not a lot, and we were all struggling around. It started off badly, not with me and Stirling, but with Stirling and the team. We turned up at Mallory Park for the first test, and they'd spelt his name incorrectly, as in pound sterling on the door, which he was not very pleased about at all, as you might imagine. And he was just a bit frustrated about the whole thing. But Overriding memory, I'd never met him before. We were doing a team picture at Silverstone behind the BRDC sort of bungalow they used to have at the front there. And we were changing in the gents' toilets because there was nowhere else to change to put our overalls on for a picture that they use in an advert actually later on. And I'm putting my fireproofs on in the gents' toilet of the BRDC bungalow with Stirling Moss. It doesn't sound right, does it, actually, in the end? But I'm thinking, this is a bit surreal. lovely man, amazing driver, and what he's been through personally, you know, the trials and tribulations he's had personally, you know, with his incidents and accidents and health, is just extraordinary.
Remarkable man. Right, we're coming towards the end now, and I haven't got through all of the questions, but we've got through quite a few, and actually we've answered... in a way, in a roundabout way, some of the questions that have been asked. So I do thank you all for posting your questions, and I hope we've managed to get through as many topics as we can. So I'm going to bring things to a close, and I'm going to put this man on the spot. Sorry about this, Simon. Right, Adelaide, 1994, F1. The podium is Nigel Mansell, Gerhard Berger, and Martin. What did Martin say about that podium in his book?
I don't know. Well, I have to confess that I wasn't there, and B, I think I probably watched it on telly and then went towards the Formula Ford Festival. But the
that was the combined age of those drivers.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it was 111, and the phrase "old duffers."
Yeah, is that what I said? How disrespectful.
I do think before we close, one thing we haven't discussed is apart from Halos, is 2018.
That was my segue.
Sorry. I've just stolen his segue. Anyway, looking ahead to there, do you think it's going to be more of the same, Mercedes Ferrari, or do you think Red Bull going to interlope a little bit? We've only had two tests as we speak. It's hard to know exactly the picture that was painted by that, but how do you see things evolving?
I hope that Ferrari and Red Bull can take it to Mercedes. You know, I admire Mercedes, and you can't blame Mercedes for anything. They're working to a set of regulations, and they've just created the best team and the best car, and well done to them. But of course we want surprises, and we had a few last year with Ferrari taking it to them on certainly in the early part of the season, and of course Red Bull, for example Verstappen in Mexico. So I really hope that they're close by. I mean, unfortunately, the way the playing field is in Formula 1 at the moment is, and it's got to change, the haves and the have-nots are just too far apart. We don't have our FA Cup days when, you know, the minnows can beat the champions. And if you've got $150, $200 million head start on a midfield team, and you've got 1,000 people working tirelessly on, you know, making a racing car better, it's going to be faster. It's going to be more reliable. And, you know, so in a way, you asked me the question because we know the pecking order of the teams. I think the midfield could be more interesting this year. McLaren should be getting their act together. Haas look good. For example, Renault look much better. I think there's going to be some great racing there. I just hope there's great racing at the front as well. My gut feeling is that Mercedes... I don't think I'm going to run and hide, but we've only had the test. Let's wait and see. And you don't know who's running what fuel levels, all the normal caveats of winter testing. But in my heart of hearts, I've got a feeling Mercedes might be relatively stronger than they were last year.
Yeah. It feels like they've got something and not something in hand.
I hope that's wrong.
Right. My segue before Simon ruined it for me. It was an age thing. And I looked at doing some research on driver ages, and we've got six drivers who are over 30 in Formula 1 this year. Looks like we've got eight or nine that are 25 to 28, and we've got 2, 4, 6, 7 who are under 23 years old. So there's seven drivers in Formula 1 this year who are younger than you were when you made your debut. You're 24, I think. Yeah. Is that right? 24. Okay. Let's pick out the superstars from those groups, okay? So I wonder if you could pick, you don't have to say which one's the best, but the guys who are absolutely at the top of their age range. Mm. So under 25s, Stroll, Verstappen, Ocon, Sorokin, Gasly, Sainz Jr. and Kvyat.
They They are. Kvyat's not in, is he?
Oh, that was last year. He's out.
I'm trying to think which car he's driving. That's a trick question.
His Ferrari's 15th reserve or something.
I wish he was still in a car, actually. That's a great group, isn't it, though? Science Junior, I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
Ocon is a star of the future.
I think Ocon's the
superstar there, of course, is Verstappen. Yeah. That kid's got a feel for grip that I haven't seen for a very long time, and probably for
since you're going around the outside of Stoll.
Yeah, absolutely outstanding. So that makes me feel very good, that group of youngsters, because there's some great talent in there, and that, as always, they are the, you know, that's the future of Formula One.
Okay.
The thing that's impressed me about Ocon was when he was coming up, when he beat Verstappen to the Formula 3 title, and his reward for that was to get shuffled sideways to GP3 while Max went up. And a lot of drivers might have been discouraged, dispirited, whatever, but he went out and won the GP3 title. And I thought that was a really good sign of strong mental approach. I mean, just not worrying about the other stuff, just getting on with what he's got to do. And it's taken him a bit longer, but he's got there.
Yeah.
Okay, the over... Well, I was going to say over 25s, but they're not. They're 25 to 28. Magnussen, Van Dorn, Gutierrez, Ericsson, Perez, Hartley, Bottas, Ricciardo.
Gutierrez isn't there either.
Gutierrez
is not there. He's
also a Ferrari test. It's my deep down wish that there were another two or four cars on the grid.
Yeah, me
that's
too.
What that's what I'm doing. Yeah. I nearly put Nasser in as well. Is it? No, he's not
there.
So Magnussen, Van Dorn, Ericsson, Perez, Hartley, Bottas, Ricciardo.
Ricciardo's the outstanding one in that group. I think Valtteri Bottas did a super job against an increasingly good job against Lewis Hamilton. Yeah. Would never underestimate Valtteri.
Stoffel, jury
Stoffel, I think he's got a decent career ahead of him. I think he's come up the hard way. He's earned his seat, and I think Van Dorn, I think, is a slow burn. I think he'll just keep improving. But the guy who can steal a victory out of nowhere, which is really hard to do in motorsport, you know, win a race. As Tom Walkinshaw used to say to me, he'll nae win a mutty race, he should nae won anyway, or something like that. My impressions are terrible today, aren't they? And that's a good line, because, there's a few races I won in a Jaguar that I'm super proud of, because I shouldn't have won those races. And Ricciardo was the same in a Formula 1 car. Mm. He steals some races because of his guile. He's not really had a car yet that you'd say, that car should win the race today from pole position.
Yeah. So here's the old guys. I can't believe I'm saying this, but over 30s.
What are you going to put in there? You're not going to put Moss.
Fangio and Moss aren't doing it anymore.
I struggle with those. Nico Hülkenberg is 30, Vettel's 30, Grosjean's 31, Lewis is 33, Fernando's 36, and Kimi, bless him, 38. So, I mean, let's actually flip it around. Who do we want to stay in F1 rather than retire?
They're all household names, really, aren't they? I have a view that your peak is between 28 and 34, and I think that window will stretch a bit, but I think we'll come younger. But for me, that crossover point between skill, bravery, fitness, desire, all merges to peak 28 to 34, but then you would argue, well, hang on, what about Mansell and Prost? But I think back in those days, experience counted for more than it does today. There's so much simulation work, so many sensors on the car, so much data. It's a data-driven business that I think that you don't need to remember all of your springs and gear ratios and anti-roll bar settings from 3 years ago anymore, because there's a myriad of engineers to worry about that for you, and then the cars are way, way more complex to set up. So having said all of that, you know, many of those guys are beyond my 34 limit, but they're still doing a great job. Vettel, when he's in form, I think Vettel is pretty spectacular. Hamilton, when he brings his A game, he is unbeatable. I don't think there's anybody in that list that can beat Lewis Hamilton when he's absolutely on it and focused and not distracted by something else.
And Fernando
he's just a terrier dog, isn't he? He just relentlessly drives the wheels off everything. And you know, even Kimi can keep Vettel
yeah.
in line and in view, but I can't help but think I'd like to see a Ricciardo or somebody else alongside Vettel now, or an Ocon, or you know, we'll see how Leclerc goes this year, and that would, and that's exactly what Vettel doesn't want, of course. The last time Ricciardo rocked up alongside him was at Red Bull, and it didn't go well for Vettel, did it?
Yeah, he's another one, the Leclerc in the under 25s. He looks like everything points to him being a star, and maybe Lando as well in F2 this year.
Oh, yeah, we've got a lot of young Brits coming along, haven't we? Yeah. George Russell and so many, and some fantastic Brits, young Brits coming along. But do you know what? You can't prejudge, I don't think, these drivers, because Formula One's a big spotlight to be under, and a spotlight can either make you grow and give you energy, or it can wilt you like a flower. And so I think you have to wait and see how they handle the complexity and pressure and relentless observation and measurement that being a Formula One driver entails today.
Okay.
I mean, getting through the older ones, I agree complete with all the points you made, but in the unlikely event that I had £5,000, I could start a racing team tomorrow. The one I'd choose from a blank sheet of paper would still be Ferdy, I think. I know Lewis is absolutely unbeatable when he's on his game, but Ferdy seems to be on his game every lap of the season, pretty much. I think there's just still something about him that if I had a blank sheet of paper or starting a team, you'd probably have Hamilton in the other car, but I think I'd definitely choose Ferdy.
He brings a bit of baggage with him, doesn't he? He's quite hot to handle, but I can't disagree with you. I mean, he's incredible. His and I mentioned it earlier on, his work ethic and his relentless determination is extraordinary. He should be at least a four-time world champion by now. Mm-hmm. And I think, and something I said recently, you know, he actually needs somebody around him who's stronger than he is, but I'm not sure such a person actually exists. but he really needs somebody around him going like, no, Fernando, no, we're not doing that. You know, this is what you should do, and almost guide him a little bit. But you know, he's fallen out with, he should be in the Ferrari now, for example. He could have won championship for McLaren, but that ended in tears, didn't it, in 2007. So one way and another, if you could, you know, have guided Fernando better, I think he would be in a stronger place today than he is. But I can't disagree with your comments about his driving.
Martin, thank you. We have to wrap it up, I'm afraid. Thanks for listening as well, and thanks for your questions. It's been a real pleasure to host you here, and please take a look at the Grand Prix Trust website as well, and take a look at the motorsportmagazine.com website as well for some more information. I hope you've enjoyed this. Tell your friends, share it with your friends, comment, say some nice things about us all, please. It's always a pleasure to bring these to you. Thanks for Mercedes-Benz as well, and also thanks to our official biscuit supplier, Rob Halloway. Thank you very much, and we are going to eat those now. So we'll be back soon with another podcast. Thanks again, Martin. Thanks to you all. Thanks to Simon.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best? Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. And certainly not one of the latest models. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. I like the way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.